Welcome to Discovery Number 2. I'm Mike Adams, and we are working our way through over 500 discoveries that my AI engine has found in searching through all the research that I have collected over the last couple of years. And this one involves vitamin E and Alzheimer's disease. It's based on a really interesting study that was published in 1997 in the New England Journal of Medicine. And it found that among advanced stage Alzheimer's patients who were given 2,000 IUs of vitamin E per day, which is a fairly high dose, you know, higher than what most people might get, but it's still a reasonable dose, that those people were able to care for themselves for an additional 7.5 months compared to the placebo group. And remember, this is among advanced Alzheimer's patients. And so all of them were, you know, headed on a downward spiral of neurodegeneration, let's say. But the vitamin E had such a strong neuroprotective effect that it allowed those taking it to take care of themselves. Again, an extra, 230 days is what was cited in the study. And the authors of the study, in writing up their conclusion, they noted some of the important things about vitamin E that I would, of course, mention, that it's fat-soluble, right? So vitamin E is transported by lipids, and it goes into solution in the lipids. And, of course, that means, you know, your brain cells and also your skin cells and other cells throughout your body. This is the single most important antioxidant, and it also has other properties, that involves the cell membranes, you know, which are made up of largely lipids. And this interrupts the chain reaction of lipid peroxidation, which is, in layman's terms, lipids going rancid, you might say. So vitamin E is kind of a cell membrane preservative, a natural one, for your cells to prevent them from, you could say, aging too quickly. And that's what the study actually found. And, you know, vitamin E, it embeds itself in your cell membranes, and it protects you from bad lipids or bad substances that are carried in the lipids. And because we live in a world of seed oils, where so many products out there, from salad dressings to, you know, cheap vegetable oils and restaurant food made with vegetable oils and all kinds of pasta sauces and so many things made from these cheap, in my opinion, toxic seed oils, including, you know, canola, etc. Protecting yourself from those toxic seed oils is, I think, a very important nutritional strategy. Now, this original study was partially replicated later in 2014 in a study published in JAMA, Journal of the American Medical Association. It was about the Veterans Affairs that cooperated with this study, involving 613 patients with not advanced stage Alzheimer's, but mild to moderate Alzheimer's. They were all on pharmaceuticals for Alzheimer's already. These were acetylcholinesterase inhibitors. And they were also on 20 milligrams per day of memantine, or I'm sorry, one of the groups was put on memantine, or memantine, however that's pronounced. And then the other group was put on the 2,000 IUs a day of vitamin E. And it showed that vitamin E significantly slowed the functional decline. The annual decline was reduced by 19% compared to placebo, which translated into an extra 6 months of functional living for those veterans who were taking vitamin E. So think about that study. It also revealed that then there was less time required from caregivers to care for those Alzheimer's patients. So it was pretty amazing. And, you know, if that were a pharmaceutical, it would be called a miracle drug, but it's just vitamin E at, you know, 2,000 IUs a day that had that benefit, neuroprotective. Now, in looking at the mechanism of this, it's kind of interesting. According to the study authors, the mechanisms include a reduction of neuroinflammation, and it helped to reduce cytokine production. And it also mentioned that in these models involving glutamate excitotoxicity, I mean, you know, we could talk about MSG also kind of related to this, but this is the intrinsic mechanism in the brain. You know, there is a natural glutamate pathway. But with glutamate excitotoxicity, which is highly relevant to Alzheimer's, by the way, the different forms of vitamin E reduced reactive oxygen species in neurology, and it downregulated NMDA receptor expression following any kind of neurological injury, probably stemming from neuroinflammation. And by the way, I have to wonder how many people fall to Alzheimer's because of vaccines or a lifetime of eating MSG or, you know, other insults, even using toxic fragrance products. I mean, I don't know the answers to that, but anything that is neuroinflammatory, when it's consumed or if you're exposed to it on a chronic basis, you know, that can have an impact. And perhaps the impact is, you know, somewhat adds up over time. So given the fact that all these patients were already on other drugs, and some of those drugs actually, you know, really harm the brain, by the way, you know, Alzheimer's drugs can cause further degradation of cognitive function. I think these study results are quite amazing. Pretty optimistic findings, actually, just for something that's so simple, so low cost, and is readily available over the counter, just vitamin E. Now, what's interesting is those who try to downplay the studies say, well, vitamin E didn't make them smarter, didn't show that they had better cognition, but they just had better self-care. Well, better self-care means you're functioning better. You know, you have a better quality of life. If you can take care of yourself, if you can dress yourself, if you can use the toilet by yourself, that's quality of life. And we're not trying to test them on a, you know, a pop quiz about calculus or physics or anything. This is about people being able to take care of themselves and have some dignity in their last days of life as they are, you know, they're plummeting into advanced Alzheimer's and ultimately death. So if vitamin E can help ensure a quality of life or extend that quality of life while people can take care of themselves, that's a big deal. Again, especially given that there's virtually no negative side effect of this. Although, you know, you should always talk with your naturopath if you're going to start taking vitamin E. It can interact with anticoagulants, by the way, so that's one thing to note. But there's virtually no negative side effects. Vitamin E is naturally found in many different types of foods, especially nuts and seeds, by the way. It's readily available as an over-the-counter nutritional supplement. It's very affordable. And personally, I take vitamin E anytime that I go out to eat. So if I'm at a restaurant, let's say if I'm eating at a Mexican restaurant, and what do they normally serve? A basket of chips with some salsa, even before your meal. And that basket of chips is, of course, fried in whatever cheap oil they could get. You know, Mexican restaurants aren't known for using expensive oils. It's not gonna fry it in olive oil or coconut oil or beef tallow. They're going to use, you know, corn oil or canola oil or soy oil, whatever is the cheapest, right? And those seed oils have an impact. It's not, those aren't the kind of oils that you're supposed to be eating. So I take vitamin E. I continue to enjoy the meal because usually that's a social engagement. I'm sharing a meal with friends or colleagues or something. So I'll go ahead and do that, but I'll take vitamin E at the same time. I also take vitamin C following these meals. And I do a few other things, like I drink, you know, fruit pulp, or I eat an apple or something like that. I'll make sure I have good fiber, but also I take vitamin E and vitamin C. Two really basic, almost old school nutritional supplements that have extraordinary benefits. So given that something like this is available with virtually no downside and a well-known neuroprotective component, might be worth considering adding to your own diet or your own supplementation. But, you know, do your own research. I'm not your doctor. Don't take this as professional medical advice. This is just discovery number two of now over 500 discoveries that have been identified by my AI research engine, all running locally, by the way. Actually, I'm looking at it right now. 534 discoveries, and it's still going. My goodness, this is going to take a while. If I do one discovery a day, we're a couple of years into this already. So we'll see. There are a number of discoveries about vitamin E, by the way. Let me just read you the headlines of some of the other discoveries that were found by my engine. Here's just the headlines. Vitamin E extends human cell lifespan beyond genetic limits. Wow. Here's another one. Vitamin E protects cell division machinery from oxidative damage, which means, you know, potentially pre-cancer. Let's see. Refined flour removal of vitamin E causes heart disease. There's another discovery. And of course, if you refine flour and you make processed white flour, you're taking out the vitamin E. That's one reason why white bread is so, frankly, you know, in the long run, toxic, because it's lacking the nutrition that it's supposed to have. And that can cause heart disease, according to this study. Here's another one. Let's see. Improved vitamin E derivative enhances cancer cell killing. That's interesting. And vitamin E succinate selectively inhibits oncogenes and cancer growth, so that, you know, slows the growth of cancer. So anyway, those are just some of the other headlines or discoveries, I'm sorry, that mention vitamin E that my discovery machine has so far found. And I guess we'll get to those later. Just the longevity headline sounds pretty interesting all by itself. So we'll dig into those in later episodes. This is brought to you by our Bright platforms. You can follow more of my work at brightvideos.com. And you can also read my articles about this and other topics at naturalnews.com. And there you'll also see my infographics. So thanks for checking it all out. You can follow me on brighteon.social, where my username is healthranger. Or you can reach me via Telegram at realhealthranger, where I post all my content there as well. So thanks for listening, and enjoy your vitamin E. Take care. Welcome to this analysis that I call the oil emergency of 2026 and 2027. I'm Mike Adams, and I want to give credit to Dr. Chris Martinson, who did an outstanding analysis of the oil situation and the accumulating shortages, but also Mike Rothman of Cornerstone Analytics and Rick Rule. They were part of an interview that I found that was also very observant. And so I took their work and then I dug a lot further. I expanded it. I unleashed some AI agents to do more research from all three of those people, and then came up with what I'm about to present to you today. I'll try to keep it as simple as I can, but this topic is a little bit complex, so bear with me here. And the first thing to start with is that we've been told year after year that there is a massive oil glut, that there's 1 billion barrels of oil floating around on the ocean somewhere, just on the ships. I mean, I'm simplifying it, but that's been the narrative. It turns out that was always a lie. There isn't an oil glut. And of course, because of Trump's war with Iran, that has rapidly transitioned into an oil emergency, oil scarcity. So used to be maybe 3,000 tankers a month would go through the Strait of Hormuz. And now that's collapsed down to less than 5% of that number. And about 20 million barrels per day of crude oil and refined oil products would normally go through the strait. That number is down, obviously, considerably, depending on the estimates that you look at. It could be down as much as 80 or even 90%. So almost 20 million barrels, let's say 16 million barrels per day of crude and refined products is missing from the world stage. And the thing is, the amount of oil that's missing adds up every single day. This is something that Chris Martinson really pointed out, that if this extends another month, you know, you're talking about hundreds of millions of barrels of oil that are missing from the economy, not to mention the natural gas, the urea, the fertilizer, and the other products like helium and sulfur that are also missing from the world stage. And the bottom line is, because these are missing, it can't be just instantly created out of thin air like waving a magic wand. There's no instant recovery from this. And for each day that goes by, it's going to result down the road in some number of people going hungry, or some amount of industrial output being crippled or being impossible because of the lack of energy. And what's even crazier about this is that, of course, Trump and his administration officials are manipulating public perception, manipulating the paper spot price of oil to keep it artificially low, to try to create the impression that gas is affordable, etc., which is causing the U.S. to sell off its strategic petroleum reserves at an artificially low subsidized price to foreign buyers. So we are draining our strategic reserves, shipping the oil out to foreign buyers, shipping it to other countries. Remember, Trump was bragging about, they're all coming to the Gulf of Mexico to get our oil. Yeah, to get our artificially low-priced subsidized oil that's effectively subsidized by the American taxpayers, ultimately, which means that the American people are paying, in part, for the oil that's being used by other countries. Trump doesn't tell you that, does he? No. Meanwhile, our reserves are plummeting at an alarming rate. And this was not the whole, this isn't the reason to have strategic petroleum reserves, not to sell it to other nations at a subsidized low price. That's a perversion of the whole purpose of the SPR. The purpose of the SPR was to have oil in times of war if oil supplies were cut off. You know, oil for America. So the bottom line here is also that oil is not only massively underpriced, especially according to Rothman's analysis, but that it could go into the range of $180 to $200 per barrel within several months, or let's say towards the end of the year, let's say the fourth quarter of this year, you could see oil at $180 a barrel or even higher. And this is a rigorous analysis. And what Rick Rule points out is that you also need sustainable capital. You need capital liquidity in order to be able to fund projects, including farming. Food production requires borrowing money. Oil exploration requires borrowing money. Building pipelines, borrowing money. Shale exploration, in particular, is extremely expensive. And without the capital liquidity to fund these kinds of projects, even if there are much higher prices, let's say, for oil, you can't just quickly respond by building a shale exploration or shale exploitation facility. It doesn't happen overnight, especially when there's no capital available or the costs of capital are much higher than they had been historically. And so between those two things, well, I guess it's three things. The global oil shortage that's getting worse by the day, combined with the inevitable rise in oil prices, combined with the lack of capital liquidity, we're facing a convergence, a superstorm, an economic superstorm that we have never experienced before. And it's going to be bad. Now, here's what else you need to know about oil and shale, is that a typical oil well will lose about 5% of its output per year if you don't maintain them. And if you just keep pumping, 5% per year disappears. And right now, the capital expenditures on oil infrastructure, almost 90% of those capital expenditures are spent to maintain existing oil fields, or shale fields, or even gas fields. It's just to try to stop the natural decline. You know, you have to inject gas in order to push pressure through the fissures and keep some, at least low pressure oil flowing through the system, for example. And there are a number of methods to do that. It's a very complicated science, actually. But it requires billions of dollars every year just to keep the oil flowing out of existing wells. And when you have a lack of capital liquidity or a higher cost of capital, and by the way, the 30-year treasury is now, I think it's over 6% in America, and the 10-year is, I think it's over 4.5%. It's creeping up towards 5%, which is, that's where alarm bells will start ringing. But even in the oil industry, capital costs are rising. So as capital costs rise, that means it's harder and harder to be able to service the loans that are necessary for the capital to flow into the maintenance of the oil extraction projects. So that means you're going to have less maintenance. You're going to have lower output of the existing wells by, again, roughly about 5% per year is what happens if you don't have good maintenance. On top of that, if any of the oil wells in the Middle East stop producing, that is, if they're shut down because there's a glut of oil, and we've talked about this, some people suspect that's the case on some oil wells in Iran right now because they're flaring off some of the oil wells. Well, if you ever stop the flow in a mature, especially a low-pressure oil field, if you stop the flow for an extended period of time or even as little as 4 days, you start to permanently lose throughput because you get water that mixes in with the oil, or you can get paraffin clogs, and all kinds of weird chemistry happens underground that starts to clog up all the fissures. And you end up with potentially a loss of 20 to 30% permanently from that well. And that can happen, or it can begin to happen, in as little as 4 days. Sometimes it can happen over a period of a few weeks or a few months, but you don't really know until you reopen the well and start pumping again and you see what you can get out of it. Sometimes the well comes right back and you're like, yay, and you get 100% back. Other times you get 60% back and you don't know until you try. So it's a crapshoot right now of how much oil is going to come back out of these wells if they are shut down, even for a short period of time. And so when you put all of this together, what you realize is that there's going to be an oil shortage for many years to come, even if the Strait of Hormuz is reopened again. And this is part of what's feeding into the projections of oil moving much higher in price toward the $200 a barrel level. So according to the IEA, which, by the way, that's the International Energy Agency, this was established after the oil crisis of 1974. So the IEA is kind of the official, you know, number tracker of the oil industry, even though it's an NGO itself. It's not part of any government, but it's an industry group. It's actually headquartered out of Paris. And the IEA sort of tells the world how much oil there is and how much excess capacity there is and how much oil is on the water, etc. Well, of course, the IEA, like any organization, has been heavily politicized. Politicized to keep the price of oil artificially low. And the IEA estimates that there are something like 4 or 5 million barrels per day of excess oil capacity in the Persian Gulf region. That is, that countries like Saudi Arabia could tap into if they needed to. And also it mentions the UAE as being part of that. However, however, what Rothman is saying is that that spare capacity is really more like only 2 million barrels per day out of Saudi Arabia and the UAE, and that the UAE, as a side note, just got bombed by Iran. Just got bombed. One of its port facilities that I believe is used for exporting oil, in fact, I'm sure of it, it's the facility that's used to bypass the Strait of Hormuz, just got bombed. So, and the UAE seems to be on the verge of declaring war against Iran. That's not going to go well for the UAE, but none of this supports the idea that there's going to be all kind of abundant oil flowing anytime soon, which means that the so-called oversupply projections of the 2026 oil marketplace were based on things like this calculation of excess capacity out of the UAE and Saudi Arabia. And that's done now. That's blown up, at least the UAE is. I mean, the Saudis still have lots of different ways to export oil, but every single method is under attack right now. So, again, the oil is actually in an emergency drought, not a glut. And what Rothman was saying in a recent interview is that we were going to face an oil supply crisis in late 2026, even without the war with Iran. That the IEA's numbers were wrong, and that the degradation of the oil wells was catching up, and there really wasn't much excess capacity, even though world oil demand remained very strong and in some countries was rising dramatically as they were becoming more industrialized with more transportation, etc. The bottom line is that we were already about to face an oil problem, a supply chain problem, in late 2026. And then, with Trump's Operation Fury added on top of that, all of a sudden that accelerated it to the present. Now we have an oil emergency that is about to kick in with ramifications on a global scale that will almost certainly lead to global economic depression. So why do we know that? Because number one, the tanker traffic is all interrupted. Thousands of tankers are still stranded in the Persian Gulf, and despite Trump's new promise that we're going to escort them out of the Persian Gulf somehow, that's a fantasy, and it hasn't happened, and it's not going to happen because Iran will just bomb the ships trying to do that. Iran has already announced to everybody, don't you dare go through the strait without our permission. Secondly, because of this inability to load and export oil, you're going to have oil well shut-ins. And the shut-ins, it's a shutdown of the oil wells. And I already talked about how that will cause permanent throughput production loss of those oil wells up to 30%. But again, you don't know. It's a case-by-case basis. Depends on how long it's shut down. Depends on the chemistry under the ground. Depends on lots of factors. But you won't know until you try to start them back up. But the longer this war goes on, the longer those wells stay shut down, and for sure, the worse the recovery gets. So it's not just that the oil is missing every day, it's that the future oil is missing every day that this goes on. The future oil situation is going to be a lot worse. On top of that, this war has resulted in a lot of damage to oil export infrastructure. Not only have Israel's attacks on Iran damaged oil infrastructure, but Iran's attacks on the neighboring Gulf state nations in retaliation has also severely damaged a lot of oil infrastructure, including what I just mentioned in the UAE. But also outside of oil, just considering gas, Qatar Energy has taken a lot of damage. Bahrain just declared a state of emergency, and exports out of Kuwait are at least partially halted the last time that I checked. And all these countries are declaring force majeure in one way or another because they can't meet their export requirements. And then on top of that, if there's going to be further U.S. attacks on facilities such as Karg Island, which is where most of Iran's oil is actually exported, then that will hamper the situation dramatically for the world. The world will potentially lose out on millions of barrels per day for a period of years. And if that happens, then global depression is a certainty, and global starvation is also a certainty, although there's a delay period before that kicks in. But you'll start to see mass famine and hunger in late 2026 and then throughout 2027. It's going to get bad. So how bad? Well, if you look at the numbers just from March, the Persian Gulf producers of oil, that's Oman, Bahrain, Qatar, Kuwait, Iraq, UAE, and Saudi Arabia, they are losing, according to Rothman, they've lost 12 million barrels per day of crude oil and natural gas liquids, 12 million barrels per day. Goldman Sachs also ran their own analysis of this, and they said it's even higher. They said it's 14.5 million barrels per day, or about a 57% reduction of where it should be. Now, remember, this includes both crude and natural gas liquids, so it's more than just 20 million barrels that we're talking about here. It's, you know, it's more like around 30 million barrels total. But this is a huge decline that has not been resolved, and it adds up every day. And when you add to that the fact that Ukraine drone strikes have targeted Russian oil infrastructure, both refineries and export facilities and storage facilities also, that we're talking about a global attack on oil supply that continues to mount up and get worse every single day. And you've heard the term like an air pocket in the fuel lines. Well, this is an air pocket in the oil supply of the world. This air pocket is now, what is it? It's in its third month. And given that there's no solution to this war in sight right now, this air pocket could end up being 6 months. And even when you try to turn everything back on, like I said, you might not get full production. You might have lost 20 or 30% of production. So in effect, there's going to be some level of an air pocket that lasts for years. For years. I mean, Qatar Energy, for example, said it will be 3 to 5 years to repair the two natural gas trains that have already been destroyed, two out of their 14. So this situation literally, physically cannot be resolved overnight. It's going to play out, and the longer the war goes on, by far the worse the long-term ramifications will be. And it's also worth pointing out here something that Rothman said in the interview, is that, you know, the U.S. is the second largest crude importer in the world after China. We import a lot of oil. It's the heavier feedstocks, you know, like Venezuelan type of oil, compared to the light shale crude that is produced largely in the United States. You know, we export a lot of that, but we import, what, six and a half million barrels per day or something like that. We import a lot of oil every day that goes through our refineries. Well, that oil is going to become more scarce and more expensive. And that's one of the reasons why fuel prices are rising so quickly right now. And I don't know if that number is exactly 6 million barrels per day, but it's something in that range. It's millions of barrels per day that we import into the United States. Now, remember that this oil, after it's refined, becomes diesel fuel. And diesel fuel is the single most important fuel source for the U.S. economy and arguably for economies like Australia and Canada and New Zealand, etc. You got to have diesel because it runs the trains and it runs the trucks. If you don't have the diesel, you know, your economy shuts down. And diesel will become incredibly scarce. And yet, because the Trump administration wants to try to manipulate the prices and make everything look better than it is, he will keep, you know, through his speech and his tweets and also some market manipulations and maybe releasing more strategic reserve oil, he will try to keep diesel prices low, even though right now they're almost $6 a gallon on average, or at least headed close to that. And it's really only high diesel prices that would send the appropriate signal for diesel conservation or companies using alternatives to diesel that would result in lower consumption. So in other words, the high prices are the solution to the shortage because it forces people to look at alternatives. But artificially low prices effectively encourage more consumption of a fuel that's going to be in short supply, making the shortage worse. So in other words, the Trump administration's manipulation of the price is going to send the wrong signal to consumers and companies, and they will end up burning through the lower supply more quickly than they otherwise would. Now, there's another huge problem in all of this, which is that Even though the IEA helps coordinate the release of strategic petroleum reserves, and the U.S. is part of that, it can't even come close to making up for the loss of over 20 million barrels per day that would have otherwise been flowing through the Strait of Hormuz. So the U.S. can release like 1 or 1.5 million barrels per day. That's a drop in the bucket compared to the 20 million barrels that we're losing right now. And then, you know, the other millions of barrels per day that will be lost in terms of throughput once everything tries to restart. And so even though the IEA has arranged to release 400 million barrels of oil over, I think, a period of like 120 days or so, that's not going to make up for the loss, and is not going to keep prices low. So eventually, we run out of strategic reserves. Eventually, all of the BS stops working, and prices will slingshot higher, along with extreme oil scarcity and diesel scarcity and kerosene scarcity, you know, jet fuel and all of that. And if you thought it was bad that Spirit Airlines went out of business and that other airlines are cutting back on tens of thousands of flights, just wait. That's going to get a whole lot worse. At the same time, there's not nearly as much investment in U.S. energy extraction and exploration as there used to be. Now, Rick Rule, for example, was citing the AFEs, or authorizations for expenditure on land that he has an interest in. And he was citing companies like ExxonMobil and Occidental and EOG. And he said that their rate of expenditures has, quote, fallen off precipitously, which means there's not nearly as much exploration taking place. And by the way, shale wells, they lose 74% of production in the first year. 74% of production. So, I mean, wow, you have a new shale well rolling and you've taken out almost everything that it has in just 1 year. That's very different from oil wells, by the way. So you have to constantly invest, you have to constantly explore and drill and extract. And if that cycle stops, then you're going to end up contributing to a horrible shortage, which is exactly what is shaping up right now. So if you put all of this together, this is why, with rigorous examination, oil is likely headed towards in the range of $200 a barrel by the end of this year. Right now, Brent is trading at more like $110 a barrel. And in recent weeks, it's been as low as 90, and it's been as high as $126, something like that. It's going to go much higher from here. And the Trump administration and all the different manipulations they pull in the markets and so on can only hold off the price increase for a short period of time. Now, I wouldn't be surprised if oil goes over $200 a barrel this year. But a lot of it depends on how long this war goes on in the Middle East. So that's the number one driving factor of this. Secondly, as a disclaimer, I want to just say, hey, don't take this as investment advice. I am not encouraging you to invest in oil futures or any, you know, commodities at all. I don't invest in commodities other than just gold and silver. But oil is, you know, especially volatile right now, and these projections could change dramatically based on a couple of things. I already mentioned if the war ends, that will change things. But also, what if there's a global depression and there's a massive shutdown of transportation? Then that would really reduce demand for oil. And if the depression is bad enough, or if there's a, you know, cyber attack, grid down scenario, a nuclear exchange in more developed nations or something, you know, if there are some big die-off events, even the famine and starvation that we're talking about in 2027, it's not hard to imagine that that would reduce the number of people living, which would reduce the demand for transportation, which would itself reduce the price of oil sometime in 2027. So it's quite possible that oil could spike by the end of this year. But then oil prices could really drop as, frankly, as hundreds of millions of people die across the planet. And thus, I mean, we don't want to see that happen. We know there's a depopulation agenda underway. We know they're trying to kill off people like crazy. But we don't want to see that happen, even though it would bring down the price of oil. The thing is, most of those deaths would be in African and Middle Eastern and Southeast Asian countries. Countries like Bangladesh and Sudan and Yemen, maybe Nigeria, some deaths in Egypt or India. We're talking about countries that are extremely vulnerable, like right on the edge of famine on any given day. You know, the DR Congo, for example. So these countries is where there would be a lot of die-offs, and it's not clear how many people in those countries really use oil on a daily basis. Probably their energy consumption is a lot less than your or my energy consumption. So even a large global die-off like that might not reduce demand for oil that much. It's hard to say. I guess somebody could do projections on that, but I haven't done those projections. So take all of this with a grain of salt, you know. Make up your own mind of where you think this is going, and pray that we can keep everybody alive. Pray that we have enough fertilizer, enough food, enough energy to keep people alive. Even though clearly the globalists want the opposite. They want to depopulate the planet. That's their goal. And I think this is part of the way that they are working to do that. So, yeah. Keep that in mind. And by the way, it's a good idea to get prepared. Let me plug the sponsor of this podcast, which is the Satellite Phone Store. They can be found at sat123.com, sat123.com. And they offer not just satellite phones, of course, but solar generators, Faraday bags to protect your electronics. They have the solar panels. The bags are called dark bags. You know, protects against EMP and solar flares and things like that. Plus the satellite phones, which will be very important if the power grid goes down or if telecom goes down. So check them out, sat123.com, and I think you'll be glad that you did. They're helping people get prepared all over the world. In the meantime, you might want to buy some diesel fuel, you know. Hey, I'm still using diesel that I paid $2.50 for because I stocked up on it a while ago, you know. Diesel stores a long time. I add all the long-term storage additives and so on, and I've used diesel that's 10 years old. That I've stored myself. And yeah, you'll go through the fuel filters a little bit faster, but you could stock up on those too. And you know, your water separators, you might have to separate the water more frequently because you'll get condensation and water in the diesel a little bit. But you know, modern fuel lines all have water separators in them. So you just have to do a little bit more maintenance. As long as it's not all sludgy, and what causes the sludge is bacteria. And so the first thing you should do when you store diesel, if you have a 500-gallon tank of diesel, you put in this bactericide into it, which kills the bacteria. Or at least you might think, well, really, do bacteria grow in diesel? Yes, they do. They grow in the water that condenses on the surface of the diesel. And then, believe it or not, they can use some of the hydrocarbons, and they end up clumping and gumming up the diesel. So that's why you add the bactericides, in order to give it a longer storage life. And again, I've run diesel that's 10 years old without any problems, just by storing it correctly. So anyway, diesel's kind of expensive right now, though. Will it get cheaper? Probably not. So it might be worth buying it now rather than waiting until later and hoping everything gets resolved. Now, if the war ends and the strait opens back up and the ships start flowing again, it's still going to be months of high prices until the supply arrives. So be on the lookout, you know, do what's right for you, make your own decisions about preparedness or fuel or what have you, but be ready because it's going to get pretty ugly for absolutely the rest of this calendar year and well into 2027 as well on top of that. So check it all out, stay informed. You can follow me at brightvideos.com. You can follow my articles at naturalnews.com, And you can also follow me on social media. I'm on X at Health Ranger, or you can follow me on Brighteon.social, where I'm also Health Ranger. So follow me there. I'll keep you posted as best I can. And by the way, special thanks to Dr. Chris Martinson for his analysis that also was a good foundation for me to research this story. So, hey, it's a group effort sometimes, folks. Take care. Okay, I had to give you this update for Operation Freedom, which is the Trump-announced operation to guide the ships out of the Persian Gulf through the Strait of Hormuz. Trump had put out a tweet. I think this was Sunday night. He said, countries from all over the world, almost all of which are not involved in the Middle Eastern dispute going on so visibly, notice he didn't call it a war, and violently for all to see, have asked the United States if we could help free up their ships, which are locked up in the Strait of Hormuz. He goes on and says that we have told these countries that we will guide their ships safely out of these restricted waterways so they can freely and ably get on with their business. I have told my representatives to inform them that we will use best efforts to get their ships and crews safely out of the strait. He says this is a humanitarian gesture on behalf of all these countries, etc., etc. And, of course, thank you for your attention to this matter. So, clearly he says, quote, we will guide their ships safely out of these restricted waterways. Now, immediately everybody began talking about this, and it was assumed that this meant the U.S. Navy was going to escort these tanker ships out of the Persian Gulf. When you say, we will guide their ships safely out of these restricted waterways, that implies that we, the United States, are going to send in some ships to escort the ships out, right? That's a fairly reasonable assumption. Well, here we are one day later, roughly. U.S. officials have now said that Project Freedom, as I'm describing it, FREE-DUMB, Project Freedom is not a formal convoy escort operation. Instead, they say that Navy vessels will be in the vicinity rather than sailing alongside commercial ships. So, in other words, when Trump said we are going to guide their ships safely out of the restricted waterways, what he meant is we're going to guide them by radio. We're going to get on the radio. You know, our Navy is going to get on the radio and say to the ships, come on through. And that's why I'm calling it Operation Freedom, because it's the dumbest operation ever in the history of U.S. Navy. We're not going to escort them at all. Why? Because, of course, the U.S. Navy can't even get close to the Strait of Hormuz. And it was reported by Iran, but denied by CENTCOM, that the U.S. Navy had tried to sail a smaller ship through the strait, and it got hit with missiles, and it was damaged, and it turned around. The U.S. denies that. Iran says it happened. We're not there, so we don't know for sure. But it's very clear that the U.S. Navy has not successfully been able to sail any ships through the Strait of Hormuz since this entire thing started. And certainly not enough to escort the thousands of tankers and carriers that are stranded in the Persian Gulf. Because according to other experts that I've spoken to, apparently the United States Navy has something like 11 or 12, maybe 13 free ships in the entire region, the Arabian Sea or close to the Red Sea or close to the Strait of Hormuz. Well, not even close, but hundreds of kilometers away. Maybe a dozen ships. So even if you were to take a dozen ships and sail them into the strait, through the strait, to the western side of the strait, and then start a convoy for tankers to come out, how many tankers can you accompany with a dozen ships, especially while you're under fire from rockets and drones constantly, because Iran announced to all the ships, you're not allowed to pass, you have no permission to pass, and if you try, we will destroy you. So once again, the U.S. has zero control over the Strait of Hormuz, which of course caused Fox News' Jesse Waters to declare that we have total control over the Strait of Hormuz and that we have won yet again. We are victorious. Operation Freedom is going to free all those ships from the Strait of Hormuz, according to Jesse Waters, who's got to be the biggest propagandist idiot on mainstream media today. He's become a cheerleader for the dumbest fantasy claims imaginable. So anyway, if you actually bring up a website called HormuzStraitMonitor.com, and of course, be careful to spell the word straight correctly, this site gives you some, you know, really interesting statistics about how many ships are waiting, how many ships are actually passing through the strait. In the last 24 hours, it was only two ships instead of the, you know, 60 a day or 100 a day, or in some days 120 a day. This site is actually covering the real-time cost of the Strait of Hormuz being closed. 21% of the world's oil supply is at risk. The daily cost to the world is $2.8 billion. And two countries are in critical shape because of these energy shortages, and that's Japan and South Korea. And then it also covers the liquid natural gas supply. 25% of the world's LNG is at risk, with a $0.95 billion daily cost affecting South Korea, China, and Japan. So in all, it's almost $4 billion a day that the world is losing because the strait remains closed. Now, I've recorded a separate report on the oil emergency that goes into more detail about how this builds up over time to be something horrifically destructive to the world economy. But anyway, you can check out, if you want real-time news on this, just go to HormuzStraitMonitor.com. And no, that's not my website. I don't know who runs it. I really have no idea. But I found it, and it's pretty good. It may be a Western site, actually. It seems to be kind of pro-Western media. So, you know, take it with a grain of salt. Nevertheless, Operation Freedom has failed in one day. One day. That's all it took, was one day. And as I said yesterday, it shows that there's, you know, Trump and the Pentagon have reached a point of extreme desperation. They're flailing. It's just throwing out. You know, Trump will throw out a tweet, obviously without even discussing it with anybody in his own military, just throws out a tweet. And then the naval command reads it and goes, oh my God, what did he commit us to do? We're not going to sail through the strait. We're not on a suicide run here. But Trump will do that. He'll just make stuff up and tweet it out there. So there's no cohesive planning at all. There's apparently no plan. There's no plan for the U.S. to control the Strait of Hormuz. It's just Trump reacting every day. He's just reacting emotionally, reacting, lashing out, reacting with anger or threats. I'm going to end your civilization. And then the next day, the war's over, you know, because it has to manipulate the markets and keep oil prices low in the United States. And that's all we're watching right now. It's like a demonstration of a schizophrenic plunged into a bad case of economics or something. It's really tragic to watch this. But the bottom line is, it's another operation that completely failed. Now, remember that early on, that is many weeks ago, they had announced the same thing, that the U.S. Navy was going to escort ships through the Strait of Hormuz. That was, what was that? That was in March that they announced that. And I remember reading tweets on social media. People were saying, we've won. This is the answer. We're going to use the Navy, and all the ships are going to pass through, and there's nothing Iran can do about it. We've won. And Trump announced, we've won. The war is over. We destroyed everything. And now we're in control. What happened to all those claims? That was the original Operation Freedom, and it went nowhere. Not a single U.S. Navy vessel went through the strait and rescued a ship and sailed out with a ship. Never happened. Well, why does anybody think it's going to happen now? They couldn't do it weeks ago. Why would that work now? It doesn't work because none of it's real. It's all just fantasy in Trump's mind. It's a fantasy. He's literally making it up. And then, you know, Fox News just shares the fantasy, shares in the delusion. Which reminds me of transgenderism, actually. Remember under Biden, and someone says, you know, if a biological man says, I'm a woman, and then you're supposed to go along with, oh, yeah, you must be a woman. Yes, ma'am. Right? Remember, that those were the rules under transgenderism. Well, Trump is like the queen of transmilitarism. Now, he's like a military transgender. He's a president of a failed military that self-identifies as a successful dominant military. Transmilitarism. And yes, I said queen on purpose because it's like a trans thing going on here. So he's going to pretend that our ships are guiding other ships through the strait, and then everybody in America is supposed to go along with it, like we're supposed to go along with the trans woman that's actually a biological man. Oh yeah, you're such a beautiful woman. And, oh, yeah, you should compete on the women's swimming team and the women's biking team and everything else. We were all supposed to go along with it. Now it's the same thing. We're supposed to go along with another set of delusions. It's just that these are right-wing delusions instead of what was the left-wing delusions. And frankly, you know, transgenderism delusions didn't start wars. I mean, yeah, they were annoying. Super annoying. And, yeah, some of the transgenders went crazy with school shootings, but the number of casualties involved in that is a tiny, tiny fraction of how many people Trump has killed and Netanyahu has killed. It's like right-wing delusions result in genocide and slaughter on a massive scale. Left-wing delusions result in, you know, crosswalks painted with rainbows, which is super annoying, I agree, but nowhere near the casualties that we're getting with the right-wing delusions. So we have transmilitarism from Trump, where whatever he says, you're supposed to go along with it. Like the emperor's beautiful golden robes. You're supposed to say, oh, the emperor looks so, so regal. Look at the flowing robes with the golden thread. Oh, it's such an amazing mastery of textile artistry. We're all supposed to sit there and say that Trump's flowing robes are beautiful when he's butt naked walking down the street. See? And of course, Fox News goes along with it. All the corporate media all goes along with it, just gaslighting America. But if you actually look at what's happening in the Strait of Hormuz, it's still under the control of Iran. Period. Still under the control of Iran. Despite all the talk and the gaslighting and the claims and the delusions, the U.S. Navy isn't even close. They're not there. They don't control it. They're never going to control it. Why? Geography. Geography. The only way to control the Strait of Hormuz is to control the country that sits on the north shore of the Strait of Hormuz. That country happens to be Iran. So if you want to control the Strait, you got to control Iran. Good luck. You know, good luck to any U.S. president that thinks you can march in there and, you know, conquer Iran. With what? You know, you and what army? Because we don't have an army that can conquer Iran. We don't have a navy, an air force that can conquer Iran. You know, it's funny because Trump says, we've destroyed Iran's air force and we destroyed Iran's navy. They're done. Iran doesn't need a navy or an air force. All it needs are missiles and drones. And a couple of radios to announce a few things to the ships. I mean, that's literally all they need. They don't need an air force. So to say that, oh, we destroy their air force and therefore they are conquered is absurd. Makes no sense at all. Again, Operation Freedom, because you have to be dumb to believe it. like George Carlin said. It's like the American dream, because you have to be asleep to believe it, you know? Classic George Carlin. So I'm waiting for the day when Trump says, we have escorted all of the ships out of the Persian Gulf. We've escorted them all out. We've taken them through the strait. They're all free. Even when none of that has happened, I wouldn't be surprised if he claims it. And then, you know, Jesse Waters on Fox News will announce that it's all done and the American people will cheer. Oh my God, we've won. We've solved the energy crisis. Except the problem is none of it's real. And all of those hydrocarbons are still stuck on the ships in the Persian Gulf. Just because you say something doesn't move the hydrocarbons, does it? Doesn't move the helium tanks. Doesn't move the liquid natural gas. Saying it doesn't make it real. You literally have to transport all of these products on the ships and the tankers through the Strait of Hormuz. And until that happens, Trump hasn't won anything. In fact, we're worse off than we were before he started the war at the end of February, when the Strait was open. Operation Free Dumb. Maybe next time it'll be Operation Free Dumb and Dumber. That'll probably be next week's plan, whatever they come up with then. It really is dumb and dumber at this point. So, as always, I'm praying for peace. I mean, I don't want to see people starving from lack of fertilizer. I don't want to see economies destroyed from lack of energy. I don't want to see lives destroyed. And I also don't want to see the credibility of the U.S. destroyed, or the credibility of the GOP, which is being absolutely obliterated thanks to Donald Trump. He's destroying the GOP right now. I mean, look at the polls. My goodness. Independents are down minus 40% from where they were when Trump got elected. And you can't win in America without a strong majority of independents voting for you. That's done, at least for Trump. So there are going to be some pretty strong political consequences to this, not to mention the economic consequences and the mass famine and food scarcity consequences that I've talked about in other reports. But bottom line, don't believe anything that Trump announces about the Strait of Hormuz, because it's always fake. It's always delusional. And it never happens. It just never happens. All we can do is bomb Iran, and that doesn't conquer Iran, and it doesn't open the Strait of Hormuz. So will the U.S. try another round of bombing? Yeah, maybe, probably. Will it work? No. I doubt it. I doubt it very much. And the best way for ships to get through is to pay Iran the toll. And then some are being allowed, you know, a couple a day with Iran's permission. That's how you get through the strait. All right, well, I'll do my best to keep you informed on this. And you can follow my work at brightvideos.com and my articles and infographics at naturalnews.com. Or you can follow my social media at brighteon.social. Thank you for listening. Take care.
The idea that government is able to say, we're going to biometrically track you, monitor you, watch everything you do. We're surveilled in so many areas of our lives to begin with. But this takes a different step. This is a step that says your private vehicle is no longer private at all. It is now actually property of the state to monitor you at all times.
You know, this is demonstrating what happens when you have a government that's obsessed with safety at the expense of personal liberty. Now, as you've covered, by the way, an excellent segment there, Ben, but if you move forward with this and you look at full self-driving vehicles, which will become more common and more autonomous, then it's not difficult to imagine that this technology could be required to be combined with full self-driving, where if you get into your car and if you owe taxes or if you said something wrong on social media or if you're wanted for a parking violation, the car drives you to a police station for you to be arrested, your own car. So it turns your car into a prison cell at the mercy of the state, whatever the state decides. But on top of that, also, it's vulnerable to hackers. We've seen many other cases where vehicles, their security systems, their locks, etc., have been successfully hacked through a number of methods, of cyber warfare methods at the local level. Imagine this kind of system being hacked where you're not allowed to control your car any longer, and you might be a a woman fleeing attackers in a parking lot late at night. You might have already been attacked. You're trying to get away from a dangerous situation. Your car won't let you. So what I see is a future where there are going to be massive consumer lawsuits against the automakers and against the government for trapping them in their own cars and possibly causing them harm.
Yeah, I wonder at this point how long it'll be before there is some kind of immunity given to car makers, like we saw with the pharmaceutical companies and vaccine companies, that says they're not responsible for anything terrible that might happen here, because this is about public safety. You started out by saying it's once again a place where we trade our personal liberty for safety. Benjamin Franklin famously said those who would trade their liberty for safety deserve neither and will have neither. The reality is that we've played this game for so long, and yet I feel like in general, the public just doesn't really see it. They don't see a problem with this. They've been so trained to believe that this is acceptable on some level, they just kind of go along. And the people who will resist it will, I guess, become the market for every car built before 2026.
Or perhaps black market modifications of vehicles. I imagine that would be very popular. But I would think that the car industry itself doesn't really want to implement this particular feature. I would have to check and see what they're saying. But, you know, there is a history of certain safety features that have saved lives without imprisoning you in your own vehicle. For example, airbags. You know, airbags, great success. Anti-lock brakes. Even the original seatbelt laws, you could argue that, you know, those did save some lives. But I always defer to personal choice, especially on your personal property. If you buy a car, it should be under your control, and your ability to drive it is up to you. If you are crazy enough to choose to drive drunk, then hopefully you will be caught and you will be fined and you'll have your license taken away so that you don't endanger others. But it's not up to the car itself to decide your mental and physical state. And that's a very gray area anyway, and it's going to have a lot of false positives.
The other reality is this. If this were really about preventing drunk driving, there are already breathalyzers that exist that are attached to vehicles where, you know, if somebody is on parole, or some people when they have been sentenced after having been involved in a drunk driving incident, they'll have a breathalyzer attached to the car and they have to breathe into it in order to be able to drive, right? If it was really about that, you would just mandate that every car have a breathalyzer in it. Instead, what they've mandated is the ability to add surveillance on all these other levels that really have nothing to do with whether or not you're drunk or not.
Well, that's exactly right. And also, I don't think they're considering people with physical disabilities, because there are many people who are perfectly capable of driving in a safe manner, who may have tics, they may have motion because of different degenerative diseases, that they do not physically move in the same way as someone else. They might be flagged as being drunk when they are not drunk at all. So this is discrimination against the disabled and their access to public roads.
Yeah, I would be willing to wager that in a very short time after this technology comes out, what we're going to find is that it does nothing to prevent drunk driving, because what they're actually looking for with most of the technology really has nothing to do with that. It might stop it a couple, you know, here and there. But I think for the most part, it won't, because, again, a lot of the patents, if you look at what Ford is trying to patent, it really has very little to do with impaired drivers. It has much more to do with how do we monitor them. And, of course, we know insurance companies want it because they want to be able to say, well, this person's driving at this speed. And we know that even with a lot of the vehicles out there like Teslas, it has the ability to slow you down. A friend of mine has a Tesla Plaid, and he was driving it one time too fast, and the car forced it down to a certain speed limit and wouldn't allow him to accelerate anymore beyond that because it decided he was driving too fast. I mean, this is kind of the future we're headed toward on a lot of levels.
And also remember, they're going to extend this beyond the car.
Yes.
The next argument will be that we need to monitor you in your home for the safety of your other family members, because it's all about safety. So now we have to have government-approved cameras and AI analysis of your activity and your voice and your words in your own home.
And I'm sure that's coming as well. We know that smart TVs are already doing that. Your dishwasher is doing that to you. Really, every connected device in your home is listening to you, right? It's cataloging information. We are told it's doing that to sell us stuff, but in reality, it's about selling us stuff and controlling us and making sure you're behaving and being a good citizen. When I hear people talk about, like we mentioned it, the Chinese credit score, right? Oh, that's so terrible. That's so Orwellian. I think we're living in exactly the same system. We just have the mistake of believing that we're more free because it's being forced on us by private companies and not directly from government.
People turning into primal, instinctual animals. If they can't feed their family and their children, what do you think they're going to do? This is not just a United States issue. The United States is the hub, but the blast radius of it, of when this thing happens, is going to engulf the entire world.
Welcome to today's interview here on brightvideos.com. Thank you for joining me. I'm Mike Adams, and I'm joined today by one of my favorite guests, someone who whose work I follow and who I see as a real genuine human being, a man with a huge heart. And I really encourage you to follow his work and learn from what he's sharing. Whether you agree with him or not, he is a good faith human being working to help humanity. And it's Mr. Gregory Mannarino from TradersChoice.net. Welcome, Gregory Mannarino. It's just an honor to have you on the show today.
The honor is all mine, and I appreciate you having me. Thank you very much.
Well, I appreciate you coming and taking time out of your busy day. You do so many updates. You know, a lot of people count on you to kind of interpret what's happening. So let's just start from the top there. If you don't mind, let's talk about current events right now, you know, the financial implications of the war, et cetera. And I'm sorry if you're repeating things you've said in your own broadcast, but what kind of picture would you paint for us right now?
Well, I think people are living it. There's no reason to even paint the picture. People are seeing it. People are feeling it. People really know in their hearts what's happening. And I would believe, well, I think people that follow our work probably know the core of why we are seeing what we are seeing. But the bottom line is, yeah, man, people are being squeezed from every freaking angle. It's not going to stop until people say enough. The same mechanism that is pushing the stock market to record high, record high, record high is destroying the middle class from within. Our nation is being destroyed from within, and that's it, man. And it's not going to stop. The currency devaluation, the artificially suppressed rates, vast debt expansion, the war as a mechanism to pull dollars into the now. No other endeavor on earth creates a greater need to borrow dollars. The war is never about what they sell it as. There's always something else going on here. We are in a multiple crisis environment. And number one, what's our biggest issue right now? With liquidity. The system's drying up. Without another mechanism to pull more borrowed dollars into the now, well, we're going to end up in a Mad Max scenario. What we're going to do is end up in a worse than a Mad Max scenario as they continue to inflate the system into oblivion. What's fostering the greatest wealth transfer effect the world has ever seen, currency devaluation. Who benefits from that? Why do we need a weaker dollar? Why do we need lower rates? We, the people, don't need that. Sure, it sure as hell helps the 1 and 2 percenters here via the Cantillon effect. I don't know if you people are familiar with that, but we can talk about it. Basically, what it comes down to is when new money is created and put into the system, it doesn't affect everyone the same way. Those closest to the money, the entrepreneur class, the elite class, they get the cash first before it's devalued and trickles down to the regular guy or girl on the street. By that time, it's been sucked dry of purchasing power.
Right.
So when you hear we need a weaker dollar from a politician, a banker, or anywhere else, or we need lower rates, realize they're not talking to us. They're talking to the 1 and 2 percenters who benefit from that. In the stock market, who owns 90%+ of that? Well, it's the 1 and 2 percenters as well. So the mechanism here of artificially suppressed rates, what does it do? I urge people to do their own homework here, man, because it's just too stupid. It's too easy. Low rate sounds good on paper, but if people just take a nanosecond to see if I'm right here and open up a new page, however they're listening to this, in the time of prosperity, it's not a time when the rates are artificially suppressed and the currency is being sucked dry of purchasing power. It's the polar opposite, when rates are much, much higher and the currency is stronger. So when you hear a politician or a banker say, you know, we need this, we need that, that's not for you and me. That's for the elite class. That's the 1 and 2% class. For the rest of us here, all it does is create the greatest wealth transfer the world has ever seen. Now, the mechanism of currency devaluation, let's talk about all this stuff. It's too easy to understand. When the dollar buys less, it costs more dollars to buy anything, even shares of stock. And that's obviously stock market positive. Artificially suppressed rates creates an environment where cash must make its way to seek yield. That would be into a highly over-leveraged stock market that exists in la-la land, and it's nothing but a paper nightmare situation being built on the back of a monstrous debt bubble. And everything prices off of what's happening in the debt market. Why do people think that the Fed's been in here buying everything here and the Fed Treasury complex has not been put together so that it could be the lenders and buyers of last resort buying it all here, keeping rates artificially suppressed so cash can make its way into risk assets benefiting who? of course, the 1 and 2 percenters will be out the door before everybody else is, and everyone's going to get wiped out eventually. But until that time, you know, we just do our thing. What's the solution here? It's very, very simple. First of all, we got to say enough. We need to fix the system from the bottom up, not from the top down. The 1 and 2 percenters here, the elite class, no, they don't have our best interest in mind. Not a single one of them does. We need to rebuild this thing from the bottom, and it starts with returning purchasing power to the currency. Return power to the people. Okay, at that point, that would require, of course, much higher rates than we have now. But what would that do? That would hit the stock market on an epic scale, drive equity prices down dramatically here, and that would interfere with part of the greatest wealth transfer effect the world has ever seen, right up to the 1 and 2 percenters. So we can't win here unless the people say enough. And when people hear a politician, a banker, whoever it might be, say, you know, we need a weaker dollar, we need lower rates here, they'll say, no, this is not what we need. But again, people don't have any idea happening to them or why.
Yeah, what you said makes perfect sense. And people are being handed this illusion that they have wealth because the stock market is propped up partially because of dollar devaluation. But I want you to answer this question. The AI infrastructure investment bubble, as I call it, I warned months ago that all these announcements of these data centers can't actually be built because you don't have enough transformers because they come out of China, and you don't have enough gas turbines to power these systems. I said it months ago, and it starts coming out now. Oh, the wait time is to 2030 or beyond. You don't have enough nuclear power. You simply don't have the infrastructure. And now countries like the UAE or Qatar that had, you know, announced big investments in data center, like investment agreements, they're going to declare force majeure. They're not going to fund that because they're, you know, because of what's happening in the Middle East. So how much of specifically the AI infrastructure investment bubble, how much longer does that have before reality hits?
Well, you know, look, for the market, you mean reality?
Yeah, the market for the stocks.
For the people, the reality is here already. Okay. And most people, like, you know, they hear about business investment, CapEx, whatever it may be, in XYZ, AI, anything else here. You know, I don't really know how people actually perceive it. I mean, I think all of this is perception management here.
Yeah.
In many, many ways, they'll tell people this and tell people that. And, you know, people can just go about their days without really having a clear overstanding of what's happening or why. Now, with regard to the stock market and malinvestment, first of all, the whole system is so twisted. There's, yeah, there's nothing here. We are operating in a black hole, a debt-based system that must be fueled constantly with more debt, more currency devaluation, artificially suppressed rates just to function at the level of us. So, you know, for the regular guy, the regular girl out there, man, I don't know what they think. I don't know. I mean, I could say this, like, from an investor standpoint. Look, man, there's going to probably be cash to be made somewhere here, there, or the other place. But in my particular situation I'm at now, I think the risk is too high to be putting any real cash to work here. And even though this market has made a miraculous rebound, trading on nothing but hope since this war, and now we got this new guy, Kevin Warsh, coming in here talking about, you know, reform for the Fed, and it's all going to turn out to be the same thing because they're not going to stop devaluing the currency, keeping rates artificially suppressed, and inflating the debt. That's the mechanism that the elite class have in play for us right now. We all lose. So, you know, really, I don't know what people are thinking with regard to how they feel, the general population, about, again, CapEx investment in XYZ, anything else. I don't think it phases them at all. People are now, they're suffering. And I hate to see that. And we've been talking about this, people like you and me, a lot of people, for a very, very long time. And, you know, finally, maybe people are starting to come around. At least I hope they are.
Yeah.
And realize that it's coming down to, you know, look what's happened here to our nation here. You want to destroy a nation from within. The first thing you got to do is get the people divided and keep them there by some mechanism. That's how you weaken a nation. You bring a nation and its people to its knees. Then you throw out whatever you want here, float this out, float that out, and give people some kind of something to hang their hat onto. But the bottom line is, I think people are really starting to wake up, and this didn't turn out the way that no one thought it was going to be. And if they think it's going to stop now, I don't think, and no one knows this better than you, it's not. It's going to get much more extreme moving forward. So people need to think about what does it mean for them? You know, you could turn on Fox Business, CNBC, Bloomberg, goes up and talk about this, that, and the other thing. It all amounts to nothing. Because all, what we do realize is the mechanism behind driving the market and whatever it may be is not going to stop until they're done creating a system here of dependency on an epic scale.
100%.
And people who have literally thrown their hands up in a state of surrender. And that's not what we do. See, people, some people that follow your work, and I'd like to believe the people that follow my work here, are able to see it. But most people, because they have disconnected themselves and they feel powerless. But the bottom line is that's what they're doing by design, is make you people feel powerless, making them feel like, you know, I can't do anything. The bottom line is we could turn this all around today if we had enough people to do it. We got to band together, all of us here. That's why I talk about unity and oneness here.
Yeah.
It all comes down to that. So, you know, with regard to the question you asked, I don't know how people think about it, man. Maybe you have a better perspective on it than me, because I really don't know.
Well, so I think you and I both agree that this is it's a controlled demolition of the current system to drive people into that state of desperation and dependence and centralized control. And that system, you know, there's also a siren song that's being played for people, which is, don't worry, you're all going to have a universal high income. They don't even call it a UBI anymore. Now they're saying universal high income, like, hey, the government is just going to print money and hand it to you because they love you so much. They want you to just consume. They want you to just exist and then collect Social Security and Medicare and so on. They want to keep you on the balance sheet. Of course, in the government offices, it's like, all these people are liabilities. You know, how do we make them die younger? You know, to save trillions of dollars, right? But what level of delusion does it take for people to think that the government loves them and wants to pay them to exist?
It's a high level, man. And it's this dependency thing. It's this slave system where they have removed people's ability to even think. It's a very confusing environment for people that's unfortunate. When you can cut through it all and you realize that none of this stuff is benefiting anyone, and we're losing across the board, we're not winning anything. And the only real answer is, man, to all of this is we need to say, that's it. You know, we need to take back the system for ourselves, but there's too few of us. I really had hoped, honestly, I've been around a long time, you know, so if you, I had hoped there would be more people like us and the people that follow our work that would say it. Now, look, I always tell people that it's the minority that rules. It's not the majority. Look, in a case of the entities, whatever they are, running this nation right now, in the entire world, it's all the same thing. And they're absolutely deconstructing the current system. All the rules for the new system are already there. All the wiring, however you want to talk about it, the laws, it's all there. It's just a matter of how they can get the people to suffer more so, and then beg for a solution. Okay, this is whatever it might be. You know, you're going to be happy with this, and that's it. There's a whole new set of banking rules coming in, which I just did a paper on this morning. Surveillance. I mean, they already have, obviously, you know your customer here, and anti-money laundering rules, but they're taking this to the next level. Banks are going to be surveilling people in a way that I don't think people are ready for. It's all about control. It's all about maneuvering and robbing people of their freedoms and liberties to such a degree that they have literally surrendered. And I see this more and more every day, especially of late. I've been interacting with people that I haven't been interacting with for a while. I mean, face to face stuff, and they're all in la la land, man. They don't get it. They don't get it. And they do complain that, wow, man, you know, this is costing this and this is costing that. I can't believe this. Why can't you believe it? Did you expect things to be different? Honestly, did you really, really feel like purchasing power is going to be returned to the currency? We were going to start cutting debt here. No, I mean, but people did believe that. I mean, it's just kind of a phenomenon that has been going on now for quite a long time, that the Federal Reserve is going to end and the debt's going to be just, just all of a sudden just vanish. And, but no. The mechanism is very, very simple. It's a pressure mechanism on the people. But it's not even about the markets or about, it's about what they have in store for us. Because we're going to end up in, again, look, man, people are fixated on the stock market because that's where they want people to look. Look at the Dow. Look at the S&P. Look at the NASDAQ, right. You know, whatever it might be. The real issue is the debt market. And we just got a very incredible truth right out of the man himself. And I'm talking about Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JP Morgan, the largest bank on the planet by assets, who said, yeah, we are going to face a credit event. And, you know, man, wow, I almost fell out of my chair. Because when you hear that coming out of the mouth, this just came out of his mouth was this week, you know, trying to say this is exactly what I've been trying to warn people about is, again, it's a lockup of the system. This is what was going on in 08. That's where they rushed Bernanke in before 11 caring representatives at that point. You know all this. And, you know, if we didn't, he said, if we don't start pumping cash into the system, we won't have an economy. He didn't say a market. The market, the Dow had already fallen by 50% at that point. But it's not about a crash. It's about the flow of credit through the system. And everything right now is pointing to that direction. What are they doing? They're consistently devaluing the currency, which are units of debt. We work for this stuff. We work for the privilege to borrow the currency into existence. We don't own it. It's owed back to the issuing central bank plus interest. They created nothing. Who created that kind of a system? Must have been some kind of mastermind. It's unbelievable, isn't it? Now they're looking to control all the rails with regard to that. They're going to be putting us onto a stable coin. I call it the company store model system, which Trump signed into law in July. The Genius Act, the greatest act of bait and switch genius in the history of God's world. People should have been in revolt at that point, but no, nothing happened, of course, because again, people are dumbed down. They have no idea what's happening and or why. And this is where they can get away with whatever they want to do right now. Wars, more war, death, pain, suffering, come up with any reason, a 50-year-old reason that they dust it off to tell us that this is what we needed to now, because, you know, for 50 years now, we've been hearing that Iran is 2 weeks away from a nuke, but now is the right time. And now we're facing this global energy problem. And what's happening? The U.S. Strategic Petroleum Reserves is being sold off to the highest bidder right now. People don't even know it. People do not realize. I did a whole paper on this just recently too. The United States is literally shipping barrels around the world to foreign nations that are now facing energy shock and economic shock. This is, you know, right now, our strategic petroleum reserves are down to 56% right now. It never was filled back to 100% as Trump said he was going to do. So now we're selling off our own oil, not adding to our own reserves. Meanwhile, we have a war that's completely unresolved, of course. We have a straight under the control still of Iran. What are we at, 9-10 weeks of war now? We have not fulfilled one core objective with regard to the war, and it's an incredible thing to witness. But I don't think this surprises anyone that follows our work. They're not going to stop. And especially with regard to war, the buildup to war, this creates a greater need for more borrowed dollars than any other human endeavor on the planet, because the system is illiquid. The system is running out of liquidity. In other words, even though the world appears to be overrun with debt, there's not enough of it. There's not enough of it to keep the system functioning. The debt-based system demands that more debt be pulled into the system in greater and greater amounts exponentially. Can't stop. So that's the mechanism. That's where people don't have any idea. That's how the debt-based fiat system works at its core. It cannot function another way. So expect anything to keep pulling liquidity or fake liquidity in the form of dollars or currency into the system. And as far as the eye could see, and that means what? That means the purchasing power of the currency, the dollar in this case, is gets sucked dry faster. The debt inflates. What does that do? And then along with that, artificially suppressed rates that causes the stock market to trade on higher multiples. So you can get people like Bondi saying Dow 50,000, well, the economy is an absolute free fall. And then we're getting all this kind of propaganda, which we all said was going to happen. We all knew it from the media outlets. You know, look here, don't look over there. They prey on people reading headlines and not reading the articles themselves. Because in the article themselves, 90% of the times is the truth. People don't read it. It's amazing, man. I'm sorry
to interrupt. I just want to apologize. I'm a little bit distracted on this side because there's some hail rolling in right now, and there's some stuff happening here at the studio. But I heard everything you said, and there's a burning question I have for you here, which is, you mentioned specifically all the banking surveillance and the financial surveillance that's kicking in, and even when the establishment is pushing, you know, Bitcoin. Now, Bitcoin has been just increasingly taken over by the establishment, far from the, you know, Satoshi vision. But isn't it true that throughout history, this kind of surveillance is a preparation for capital controls?
because they know that Americans are, when they wake up, they're going to try to flee the dollar or flee the market, and they want to close all the exits before that day comes.
100%. It's even bigger than that, but absolutely. The whole thing is about the extortion of control out of people until they say enough here, of course. You know, and it's an amazing thing to watch people. Again, the more people are forced to suffer, try to make ends meet in this kind of environment, the more people are going to be willing to surrender to it instead of saying no enough. You know, the bottom line is people don't understand how the system functions at all whatsoever. And it's really not a hard thing to understand if people just realize that that based system, first of all, man, we could just go back to, let's say, for example, cash. Okay, talking about things like cash. Cash is sovereign. In other words, I want to give you $5 and I don't have to tell anybody about it, or $10, $100, right? The new system is not going to allow any of it. Absolute control from every single angle. And then, I mean, the banks themselves are going to be able to throttle people's accounts however they want. Okay, well, you know, we believe you're even if you can't prove it. Okay, by the time you prove it, you won't have access to your cash anyway. They're going to shut people down. That's what all these new rules coming in. These were proposed just a few weeks ago. I just did a piece. It's on my Substack. And I went over and asked people, you know, is this what you want? And it's all being done in quiet, just like how the United States is now selling off its own oil. First of all, look, let me say this. The United States does create oil, no doubt about it. And people will say, well, you know, Greg, you know, the United States just created its own oil and we don't need it and we don't need anybody else's oil. But the bottom line is, we now have a crisis situation, a multiple crisis situation this year, this war. When's it going to end? We've been told we were one on day one. That didn't work out so well. And now Trump is trying to build a coalition, which didn't work before, to open up the strait. But the strait was under full U.S. control. That was another statement he made like 2 weeks ago as well. Obviously, these are all just propaganda, a perception management thing for people who have no idea what's really going on here. They've all been sold a lie. And very few people, at least, well, more than a few people have bought it. But the people in the know who have at least one functioning brain cell get it. Yeah, but the bottom line is absolutely, the setup is easy to see. The new system, it's all there. You know, we're going back to or going into a system of maximum control, a system of a whole new set of rules, a whole new paradigm. And it's going to get really, really bad again when the credit event hits. And the credit event is that without another mechanism to pull more cash into the system, maybe just lock up the flow of credit. The world economy is dependent on the flow of credit debt through it. Right. That is what was locking up. Last time, the financial crisis of Ben Bernanke went to Washington and did his little spiel over there. But that's what was – and we got another warning from Hank Paulson, who lived through it. And he was the one who warned before Jamie Dimon about a credit event. Then we got Jamie Dimon. It's going to happen. What that means is, for people who have no idea, is all transactions stop. Zero. You try to use your debit card, it doesn't work. You try to go to your bank, zeros across the board. It's over. There's nothing. There will be absolute pandemonium in the streets, and they're going to bring that about to elicit and rob people of more freedoms and liberties, to elicit more control. How people can't see this happening, I just don't know.
Yeah, you and I, yeah, we sometimes it feels like we're talking to a brick wall, but then again, the people who follow your work and my work, they're very well informed and they tend to be very well prepared. And I, as we're wrapping up this segment of the interview, I want to give out your website, traderschoice.net. Encourage people to go there and check it out. But also, you mentioned your Substack. What's your Substack address there?
I guess it's just Gregory Mannarino's Substack. This is where I put most of my work these days. And if people, you know, I offer anyone a free subscription if they can't afford it. Otherwise, I do charge $40 a year. But with that $40 a year, we support charity events all over the country. We're supporting no less than 15 right now. I have cash put aside to fund other things as well. And I believe in that. You got to pay it forward, man. That's the only way to make it work in life. And then, of course, with that $40 a year, you get an invitation to a year-end lines event for you, for that person, of course, and a guest, and you're invited, of course. I hope you come down. Maybe you want to talk right over here down here in Bradenton. I'd love to have you as a guest speaker if you're interested in doing that. This is going to be in November. I got it booked already. So yeah, man. So a lot included with that $40, and I hope again, if people can't afford the $40, that's fine. Reach out to me on Substack. I'll give you a free subscription as well. But yeah. I'm trying to build something over there like you are, man. We're working together to build something. It's about people coming together and realizing what's happening to them. It really is. You know, look, man, they want us divided. They don't want us to think about each other. All they want is at each other's throats constantly. And that's why, again, the selection of Donald Trump, okay, I'm going to say it straight out, why this worked out. He's protecting the, I call them the Epstein class, and now they're protecting him, and they're the ones that are kind of controlling everything right now. It's unfortunate.
Yep.
And, you know, like, I don't know, like, I just... Look, man, it's too obvious how this is happening, what's going on. And I'm sitting here preaching to the choir, and probably all your people shaking their heads. They see it. But we got to get more people. Whoever's listening to this, share the work. Get it out there. It's too important for people just to let this go in one ear and out the other.
All right.
That's it, man. That's kind of where I see it.
Gregory, stand by then. This is the wrap up of part one of our interview. And then in part two, I want to ask you about practical solutions. There's still a time window for people to make better decisions about their assets, and you've offered a lot of analysis on that. I'm not telling you to be a financial advisor for anybody, but we're going to cover that in part two. So, folks, this has been an interview with Gregory Mannarino here on brightvideos.com. If you haven't seen part two, that's also going to be at brightvideos.com. But be sure to check out Gregory's website, traderschoice.net, and his Substack, like I mentioned earlier. So thank you for watching, and be sure to check out part two. I'm Mike Adams here for brightvideos.com. Right now, more than ever, it's critical to eliminate counterparty risk. That's my belief, and don't take this as financial advice because I'm not your financial advisor, but when you want physical gold and silver in your hands, or vaulted, professionally vaulted, insured, high security vault, etc., that eliminates that counterparty risk, which I think is an extreme risk right now. I think banks are going to fail, and we're going to have bank bail-ins. The currency is failing every day, you know, kind of little by little because of all the money printing and the valuation erosion that's accelerating. Also, because of what's happening in the Middle East, more and more countries are agreeing to sell oil in currencies other than the dollar. And the only way that treasury yields are kept low is by the Fed printing money and buying our own debt, because there aren't enough international buyers to buy our debt anymore. So our country's like a snake eating its own tail financially. It's buying its own debt, and this is going to end badly. And when it does, in my opinion, those who hold dollars, even in bank accounts or in the stock market or whatever, they're going to be devastated by the losses. Gold and silver are the best way, in my opinion, to preserve your assets and make it through the coming storm. And the best place to get gold and silver is a company I've been working with, the original founders of the group, for 6 or 7 years now. Today it's called Battalion Metals, and you can reach them at metalswithmike.com. And the reason it's called Battalion Metals now is because they did a joint venture with Tucker Carlson. So Tucker Carlson is the co-founder of Battalion Metals. It's the same group I've worked with for years. And let me tell you about these people. They are pro-freedom, pro-liberty, pro-Ron Paul type of people. They respect your privacy. They understand the importance of your security, your privacy, and the importance of giving you gold and silver at the best possible competitive prices. So there's no bait and switch. There's no, you know, rigging. There's no weird coins like, here, have this 1.5 ounce thing that nobody knows what it is. They don't play games, otherwise I wouldn't promote them. This is the same company, metalswithmike.com, Battalion Metals. This is the same group that I recommend to my family, to my friends, and that I use myself. And I stack gold and silver every month, just a certain amount every month, and I have it vaulted with their vaults because I know I can trust them, because they're professionals. They're high integrity people. They're not fly by night. They are the kind of people that you can trust. Again, otherwise, I wouldn't even be associated with them. So when you want to get gold and silver in your hands and eliminate that counterparty risk, this is the way to do it. Just go to metalswithmike.com. You can see the prices right there online in real time at Battalion Metals, or you can schedule a call with them. Just use this button right here, schedule a call. And they are trustworthy, high integrity, knowledgeable people who can help you devise a strategy that's suitable for you. Just remember, I'm not your financial advisor. I can't give you an investment strategy personalized for you. You need to do that yourself with your own advisors. You can talk with Battalion Metals, and they can help give you a lot of information and some planning as well. But make the best decision for you. And you're going to make it through this. You'll make it through the storm, even as other people lose the value of their dollars or their other investments. Gold and silver will make it through. And right now, in my opinion, gold and silver are still at an incredible buying opportunity in terms of price compared to where they're going to be represented in dollars in the near future. That's my opinion. Do your own research. Do what's best for you. And check it all out at metalswithmike.com. So thanks for watching. I'm Mike Adams, the Health Ranger. God bless you all. Take care.